Hello and welcome to the Azeth Named London Theatre Podcast for the 3rd of September 2017. My name's T.L.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Alice from Traffic Light Theatre goer Gareth James and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about Against at the Almeida Theatre. This is a new play by Christopher Shin, directed by Ian Rickson. Christopher Shin has been responsible for plays such as Teddy Ferrara, which was on at Donmar a few years ago, and other plays like Where Do We Live, now or later at the Royal Court. He's an American playwright, and he has chosen to look at the doings of a Silicon Valley billionaire who decides to leave his rockets and his AI behind and go and visit the people to find out why violence takes place. And he is doing this because he thinks he has heard voices from God. This might remind people who know about technology of at least one particular Silicon Valley billionaire. There's a man called Elon Musk who makes Tesla motor cars, also is very interested in rockets and is launching rockets all over the place. And he also is very interested in AI, especially for his electric cars, the Teslas that he builds. He also has a thing called the Boring Company, which is about digging holes in the ground because he wants to make tunnels and make a thing called the Hyperloop. Luke, the main character here, is a kind of like Elon Musk, although his desire to go amongst the people is very similar to Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, who has started to do this. And a lot of people are seeing Mark Zuckerberg's move to go and visit people in every state in America in the next few years as a prelude to a presidential run. I think he'll just about be old enough to qualify by 2020. Mark Zuckerberg is frighteningly young still. We also meet another Silicon Valley billionaire in this play. He is probably modelled on Jeff Bezos of Amazon, who runs a company called Quater, and quite a lot of the play is set in one of their fulfillment centres. Now, this production stars Ben Whishaw as Luke, and he is joined in the cast by Fehinti Balogun, Elliot Barnes-Worrell, Nancy Crane, Emma Darcy, Amanda Hale, Kevin Harvey, Adele Leonce, Martin McDougall, Philippe Spall, Gavin Spokes, and Naomi Werthner. Gareth, could you tell me more about this play and what you thought of it?
Well, the answer to the second question, what I thought of it, was not a lot, I think. I blow hot and cold at Christopher Shin. His last play we had here 4 years ago, Teddy Ferrara, which is at the Donmar, I really took against. I thought it was just so quintessentially American, and particularly American college life, that it just kind of sank somewhere mid-Atlantic and never really crossed successfully. But about 5 years before that, he did a brilliant play called Now or Later at the Royal Court, which was about the son of a presidential candidate, which I thought was fabulous, although that might have something to do with Eddie Redmayne being in it. And the previous plays, and I've probably seen, I think, three or four of them, just, I don't want to say left me cold, but I've not engaged with them in the same way as I've engaged with other American playwrights. And this is in that camp, I'm afraid. And I think, again, part of it is because it is quintessentially American. I don't think this has crossed the Atlantic very well, because you've got all the sort of celebrity stuff and the political correctness and the incidents, you know, the fact he's following shootings in schools and rapes on campuses and all these kind of things. I just think it's harder for us to identify here with the play than I'm sure it was in the US. And I think the other reason is because the lead character is just deeply unsympathetic. I just wanted to sort of walk up to the stage, pick him up by the lapels, although he wasn't wearing a jacket, shake him and say, do something more constructive with your billions, please. Because the idea of, you know, God has told me to go and visit these people who've been subject to violence was just, oh, I just kind of groaned at the whole idea, really. The first half of the play is particularly slow, achingly slow, although the pace does pick up in the second half. It certainly doesn't sustain its 2 hours, 50-minute length. And although it comes to a conclusion, which we won't talk about, I didn't feel it went anywhere. That might sound a bit odd, but I just left the theatre feeling deeply unsatisfied with it, really. I mean, Ben Whishaw is a terrific actor, and he performs very well here, but I just kept thinking, oh gosh, there are so many other plays I'd rather see him in, and so many other characters I'd rather see him play, really. I'm surprised in a way at the pacing, because Ian Rickson is particularly good, I think, at taking a play and actually creating a sort of fairly dynamic staging. But I thought it was, for him, uncharacteristically dull, as indeed Altz's design was uncharacteristically dull as well. So I thought it was a great shame and a lost opportunity. I have to confess, I was thinking of leaving at the interval, and I decided not to do. I decided to go back, and I'm glad I did, because the second half was actually better. But by the interval, I was just thinking there are other things I could do with another hour and a half of my life, really. So I'm afraid disappointment. Alice, what did you think?
I have some of your same reservations. I have to say that after the event, it has grown upon me, but that's more because of some beautifully calibrated performances than I think the story. It felt rather intangible, and your phrase deeply unsatisfying. I had the same feeling at the end of the play. We know very, very little about this billionaire. He seems to be sort of plucked out of the air. We just learn at the beginning, in a rather expositional beginning, actually, when somebody says to him, well, namely his personal assistant, who's also a journalist, Sheila, says to him, you were born abroad and your dad died when you were young. So we have that kind of context, and we do have him returning to his mother's home at one point. But he remains very, very unknowable. And it's a strange play in that way. I did feel that, and I find myself saying this more and more about a number of plays that I go to see, that maybe it was a box set that never got made, that I could see it with American landscapes. And there was some kind of psychological depth as regards the impact on the audience. It seems a very strange thing to say, but, well, not entirely. It is a theatre performance. But I did feel that the performances were so detailed and beautiful that you had this cross-section of people that he was meeting, that one was trying to find some kind of pattern in his rather Sisyphean task. You know, he's sort of rolling the stone uphill or the rock uphill and never getting anywhere. The whole premise is quite strange. Suddenly we are told that he's got a vocation from God to go where there is violence. And I was actually waiting for a discussion of how this violence is defined. We seem to be talking about the kind of violence, individual violence, that appears on news stories. There's a school shooting and a campaign on a university campus about how a particular rape has been handled, which has ballooned into something much bigger. And we never really got a definition. I was even waiting because, of course, animals wouldn't know what violence is. And violence seems such a big word. So a lot of this depended upon the performances, which I have to say were uniformly good. I did have a little bit of trouble hearing Amanda Hale as Sheila at the beginning. But other than that, it's the first time that I've seen Ben Whishaw on stage. It's actually my first Christopher Shin play. I'm a Christopher Shin newbie. There were tantalizing glimpses of the trajectory behind the play. I mean, at one point, it did mention about competition. And of course, you did have this Jeff Bezos character brought in, who one realizes had been a rival with Luke, the Silicon Valley billionaire. I do also agree with you that it's a very quintessentially American play. I think there is a phrase, movie made America, that America is a set of disparate states which have been bound by the image of America in the movies. And of course, this is more from the 20th century. And maybe that this is saying that we're not bound by the American dream and family values anymore. We're more bound by a kind of motiveless violence and a corporate ethos. I mean, there was a point in, again, a very good performance by Emma Darcy as a student in creative writing, Anna, where she says after a tutorial, which gets rather skewed by her creative writing professor, played by Kevin Harvey, she does say, it feels off. And I think that the whole play felt slightly, but deliberately, off-center. And it's that, actually, which is both its asset and its drawback, in that it has a kind of psychological reach but it's also part of the dissatisfaction that I feel with it, that it was just too intangible, but it was too long. Having said that, it felt like a box set that never got made. I have to say, at the same time, I think Ian Rickson still made it inherently theatrical. And that was a little bit surprising to me, having thought that it was quite televisual. But there was still, although it was too long and meandered rather, the pacing was still inherently theatrical rather than televisual. So it did give all the actors a chance to shine within the story. It was just that the story was just so intangible, and Luke was always so unknowable that it didn't satisfy. It did feel as if there was more to know, and that knowledge never came.
I think that the departure to the fulfillment center of this company called Equator, which is a very thinly disguised Amazon, which has, as we say, the sort of Bezos characters running it, I wonder what the point of that was, really, because he's going around places where violence has occurred, and now he ends up in a fulfillment center. Yes, the guy might be a kind of career competitor for him, but he's certainly not a business competitor for him. To me, it seemed a bit contrived to actually add in quite a lot of the play around this fulfillment center and Equator. And if Amazon's lawyers are not on the comparison between the logo used in the play and their actual logo, I shall be very surprised, because it's very, very close. What did you think, Tim?
Yeah, actually, it's a frown and not a smile. I think this is something that they might be able to get away with on the Equator logo. But yes, it is very similar. Like you, it's a very unfocused and very messy play. It really needed somebody to say, well, what exactly are you getting at? Because things don't really relate to each other. The Equator stuff doesn't really relate to the whole violence plot. It's almost contrived to get it in there. You suddenly get this diversion of the student with her assessor talking about the professor there is trying to shape her narrative in her creative writing, but she just wants to basically write a hagiography or something very complimentary towards Luke, because she worships him, and he keeps trying to reshape it. And then he has a debate with Luke, which again doesn't really get you anywhere. This is actually the world premiere, so no Americans have seen this, or no Americans that don't live in London have seen this play. So it is something that, you know, maybe Christopher Shin couldn't get anybody who wanted to play with it, or maybe people asked too many questions, and people just thought, well, it has a topicality because you can clearly identify characters like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos within this, but I don't think he really talks enough about them. I mean, it is rather irrelevant. You can see echoes of those characters, but you're never really seeing that character. And I would agree that you don't really understand where Luke is coming from. He does seem to be a perfectly normal American guy. There doesn't seem to be that much impact in any of his past on what he is in the present. And it's Ben Whishaw giving his thing of being a little bit pained and playing with his hair, which is he's something he does an awful lot, and that's about all the performance you get. I mean, there's nothing really wrong with his performance, and I think all the performances in this play were very strong. I don't think there was a weak link anywhere, and you know, it all goes along decently, but it doesn't really take you anywhere, and it is a bit of a muddle. I think they needed somebody to pare it down slightly and decide what was the important thing in the play, rather than just to present it as a whole. It's probably needed, you know, a little bit more focus.
I mean, there have been other billionaires who've sought to sort of move on and do good in the world, as it were. You know, Bill Gates and his foundation and Warren Buffett and so on, but this character, far from wanting to do good, which I quite like him to do, really, he goes on this messianic, misguided tour. And I'm kind of struggling to understand, well, what are you getting at here? You know, are you saying that this could happen, or this is another way they do it? I'm left kind of a bit puzzled about it already.
He is a generation down from Bill Gates. Is it Bill and Melissa Gates? And Maybe this is, I'm positing this, a generational thing, in that he's of the generation who have perhaps been brought up on the internet and more dislocated in virtual reality, in the world that's been created now, the internet. So maybe there is some kind of insight there into a young, oh, I sound like a real old fogey, don't I? A younger generation which is trying to find a role. It's not like this is manufacturing with something, again, I'm overusing this word, something really tangible. This is more from the world of computer games. I think there's one point where he talks about going on to another level. And I did wonder at that point, is this some kind of computer game that's happening? Because the way he goes from location to location and tackles the subject matter of what has happened in the location. I did also wonder whether the creative writing course, the student with her professor, was at one point seen as a central core of the play, which got lost. The way that people, as Tim has said, are shaping narratives, shaping stories, almost pitching stories and their case, where everything has to be a competing story and a competing narrative. But I have to say, it did get lost. It was unfocused. And in the end, everything just seemed to hang on some very detailed performances.
And all the character achieves at the end of the day is a media circus that he runs away from. And as Tim said, it's just a lack of focus that's the core issue with the play.
There is a book by Douglas Coupland, who wrote Generation X, called Microsurfs, which is all about people working at Microsoft in the late 90s, where they basically worship Bill Gates. It is a rather interesting thing. The thing I would mention, though, is that had he steered a little bit closer to people like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg in his characterization of Luke, I think Christopher Shin would have come out with somebody quite a lot more interesting. Mark Zuckerberg is a very interesting character and a rather quirky character. He's done things like deciding to only eat what he killed or grew 1 year, and he does these weird projects for himself. I suppose he can afford to. But he is a very interesting, you know, they are very interesting characters, both he and Elon Musk. And I think that if Christopher Shin hadn't just given a surface and then written his own character, but actually steered into those characters, he might have made something a little bit more interesting. We're now going to talk about Salad Days at the Union Theatre. This is a 1954 musical by Julian Slade and Dorothy Reynolds. It is, to a certain extent, the little musical that could, because it has such a slight story that you wouldn't expect it to be successful at all, but it has such innate charm that it seems to do well whenever you put it on. It was last done in London by Tête à Tête in 2009 at the Riverside Studios, and then they brought it back in 2010 and then in 2012. So popular was their particular production of it. So it's always interesting to see this little musical that could do well. Gareth, tell me more about this musical and what you thought of this particular production at the Union.
Well, it shouldn't really work in 2017, to be honest, because it's a bit of a frothy concoction. The music's quite twee. The story is rather preposterous, involving a piano with magical properties and visitors from outer space. And the characters could be kind of in a living museum, really. But somehow it does work. And as you said, I think charm is the kind of the secret ingredient, really. Because you do find quite quickly after taking your seat in the theatre, you start smiling. And then you find yourself kind of laughing with it rather than laughing at it. And in some moments, you're sort of giggling quite uncontrollably, really. It starts with the graduation of our lead characters, Jane and Timothy. They're leaving university. They make a plan to meet the following week in a park in London. He's under pressure to get a job, and he's dispatched to meet various uncles in various occupations, including banking and spying. And she's under pressure to find a husband, as women of that time, or young girls of that time, were supposed to. And there is, amongst other things, a party arranged to try and help make that happen. In the park, they meet a tramp who pays them to look after his piano. and they discover that the piano actually makes people dance uncontrollably. So they kind of stay with the piano, they have a mute companion, and they eventually get pursued by both the police and the government because they want to stop all this fun of people dancing uncontrollably. Spies turn up, one of which is an uncle. There's an attempted blackmail of a government minister in an Egyptian-themed nightclub. A spaceship arrives from Planet Z. And it's all very cheesy, but it's actually very tongue-in-cheek, and it really is rather infectious, I have to say. I wasn't planning to go and see it, because I felt, having seen the Tate-a-Tate, and indeed another production before that, I thought, you know, I've probably done Salad Days, really, but people who were raving were sort of, you know, I've got no willpower, made me change my mind, and I was really glad I did change my mind. Because it was just a delightful evening, really. The designer, Catherine Morgan's, fitted out the union with sort of fake turf, and the band's on a sort of bandstand. The costumes, I thought, were particularly good by Michael Lees. And it's got a sort of very nifty staging, and I thought some particularly funny choreography by Joanne McShane. I think Brian Hodgson is the director. Very, very good cast, mostly young, mostly recent Guildford graduates. Lowry Hamer is excellent as Jane, and particularly in good voice. Laurie Denham was another very charming lead, but sadly I thought he was too quiet sometimes. He didn't sort of pick up all his lyrics in what is an unamplified evening. There's the sort of secondary couple, James Gulliford and Francesca Pym, are paired as Nigel and Fiona. And then you have a great police double act from Tom Norman and Stephen Patrick, who have this great scene together as dancing PC and a dancing inspector. I told you it was preposterous. And Stephen Patrick actually also shines in a couple of other roles, notably as the nightclub manager in this Egyptian-themed nightclub, where Maeve Byrne steals the show as a nightclub performer called Asphyxia, and she also turns up as the woman from outer space. So, you know, it shouldn't work, but it works. And I thought it was just a lovely, charming evening, really. And I kind of, you know, I thought, well, this is fun in the theatre. What did you think, Alice?
Well, yes, I think it's an infectious show. I mean, in the best possible sense. I did learn through the good offices of Wikipedia that actually that the Pyjama Game won the award for best musical in 1955. But Salad Days got the award for the most enjoyable show, which I think just about sums it up. It's interesting, I think, as well, as a musical which is in a kind of in-between period in British musicals as well. It was before Joan Littlewood's Workshop and Oh, What a Lovely War, and before Oliver, and after, you know, Ivor Novello and Noel Coward. Well, Noel Coward was still around, but it was after the heyday of his musicals. So it's an interesting period as well in the 1950s. I too saw the show back with Tête-à-Tête. This, I think, was a solid revival. I thought that there were some excellent performances, and that Lowry Hamer as Jane, as you say, a lot of them are recent graduates from Guildford. She had a beautiful soprano voice. Laurie Denham is a great dancer. As you say, his voice is a little bit underpowered, but he had that brilliant P.G. Woodhouse, slightly gawky look. So it was well cast. I have a slight problem, I have to say, with the union as regards the acoustics. The only show that I've ever seen there, a musical, which really overcame it totally, was actually directed by Christian Durham, Children of Eden. Apart from that, it is a bit uneven acoustically, and director Brian Hodgson didn't quite get over some of the slight problems that this new union building has, and with the band as well. But all in all, I mean, I thought it's a wonderful, sunny-natured kind of musical. And having said that, it's, you know, very frothy and light, and it seems very bizarre in some ways, I think actually it's quite carefully structured. It's a review type musical. I mean, Julian Slade did come from the Cambridge Footlights, whereas Dorothy Reynolds was a seasoned actress. And I think her husband originally starred in one of the roles. It came from the Bristol Old Vic, and I think it was quite carefully tailored to meet the talents of the various performers that they had. And there's inklings in it that you can see, although it was famously, Salad Days was famously lampooned by Monty Python as a kind of bloody Sam Peckinpah movie. You can see inklings of 1960s satire actually in it. I mean, I did think of that was the week that was. You do begin to see that they are as well talking about spies. And Burgess and Maclean had quite recently defected to the Soviet Union. You have hugging policemen in the park. And there's just inklings of the same kind of sensibility that fed into things like That Was the Week That Was and the later satire boom of the 1960s. And obviously that grew out of the reviews in London in the 1950s, you know, at that time, of a lot of Oxbridge graduates. I agree that the choreography was wonderful. I felt that the costumes especially were absolutely delightful, and they crisscrossed the decades. You know, they arrived in the 1950s. It might be worthwhile mentioning as well is that there is a picnic area for certain members of the audience where they can actually sit on the ground as if they are in a park. As I said, there are some subversive notes, but it's also a very cheerful, jolly kind of musical, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. I love that kind of musical. As I say, I have a few reservations about the acoustics at the Union, but the exuberance of the show and the cast did overcome that at the end for me. And yeah, I think it's for anybody who's also interested in musicals to see as well, as I say, a musical from a little known period of English musical theatre. I think it's well worth a visit to the Union.
We're now going to talk about Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill. This is a one-woman show starring Audra McDonald, and in this show she is playing jazz icon Billie Holiday. It's written by Lainey Robertson and directed by Lonnie Price. Alice, could you tell me more about this and what you thought of it?
Yes, it's based on true events and it's set in a small nightclub in South Philadelphia. And it was when Billie Holiday, who was actually born in Philadelphia, in March 1959, she was giving a show at Emerson's Bar and Grill. And in fact, sadly, she only had a few months to live. What had happened is that she had actually just been released from jail because she took the fall for something that her husband did, guarding drugs. And she actually couldn't sing in New York clubs because you had to have a cabaret card. And because she was a jailbird, she wasn't allowed to sing in the Harlem nightclubs. So this is a portrayal of Billie Holiday at the end of her life. But of course, things that happened to her were not just something, a flaw in her personality. She was actually fighting against very vicious discrimination, even though that she did have her own personal demons in drink and drugs. This show has been going around, I think, since the 1980s, but Audra McDonald, who actually was going to come to London last year but became pregnant and so the show was put off, she's really a classic Broadway star, and she took on the show. And she does it absolutely beautifully. She's actually trained as an opera singer, but she does suppress those natural trilled operatic vocalism and does seem to get under partially the skin of Billie Holiday and does many, many songs. It's caught a little bit between a concert and a one-woman play. It's a solid play, but it's not a play that blows you away. It just goes through the various events of Billie Holiday's life, even though it's well structured. So you do get the poignant parts at the right bits and a more uplifting moments as well. Well, what can I say, except it's a tour de force by Audra McDonald. You also have to give it more dramatic structure and tension. There is a business manager, Jimmy Powers, who interjects to keep the show on course, because at various times Billie Holiday goes a little bit off track in terms of drink and drugs. And Jimmy Powers is played by Shelton Becton on the piano. There's a very good trio backing her of Shelton Becton on piano, Frankie Tonto on drums, and Neville Malcolm on bass. You do get some of the iconic Billie Holiday songs, but at the same time, some of the lesser known songs as well. And it is fascinating to hear a bit of the background as she weaves her way through the songs. You've got God Bless the Child, which many people know. You've also got, of course, Strange Fruit, which is about lynching down in the South and was written by Abe Meerpol, who later adopted the children of the Rosenbergs. Altogether, I mean, it's a miraculous show in terms of Audra McDonald's singing and the musicianship of both her and the trio. It's a tremendous show to see, to admire that musicianship. I wasn't blown away by the play itself, and I wondered what a musical, a fully-fledged musical about Billie Holiday's life would be. But I think it's something where you just don't want to miss the chance to see Audra McDonald in London giving a tour de force performance. And there's so much to enjoy as she goes through any number of songs by Billie Holiday. And yes, it has my wholehearted recommendation.
Gareth, what did you think?
There is another show, I think, about Billie Holiday. I think it's called Lady Sings the Blues, which we saw quite some time ago. This is a very specific take on Billie Holiday, because as Alice said, it's recreating a concert that she did before quite a small audience in this nightclub shortly before she died. And in between the songs, you know, we do hear a lot about her life. She tells a lot about her life, about her mother's dalliance as a prostitute, about, you know, the fact her dad deserted her, sexual abuse, the men in her life, prison, her Carnegie Hall triumph. So she's telling us a lot of stuff about her life. And as it goes on, it becomes increasingly uncomfortable because she's breaking down before your eyes. But when she sings, it's absolutely heavenly. And it is a vehicle for Audra McDonald, who I don't think we've seen in a proper show. And I think this is probably more of a proper show before in the West End. I saw her in concert about 18 months ago, I think it was. And I felt then her operatic soprano got in the way in some of the interpretations of musical theatre songs. And here she can't do that because she is recreating this kind of concert and she is singing as if she is Billie Holiday. I thought it was captivating in that sense. I did think it overstayed its welcome a bit, though. It's an hour and 40 unbroken minutes. And I felt it did stay a bit too long. And it did become a bit depressing, not, you know, because the life is depressing. Therefore, you know, you're kind of there, kind of willing her on, really. You're sort of, you know, you forget you're watching a characterization and you're sort of willing her on to sort of make it through. But nothing takes it away from what is an extraordinary virtuoso performance. I'd now like to see Audra McDonald again, but I'd like to welcome her back with something a bit more uplifting, I think, because I did leave the theatre feeling a bit down, to be honest, although I appreciate that was the material. But I too recommend it because I think she's a sort of performer that, you know, you have to see, and it is a virtuoso performance. So I certainly would recommend it, but it would be good to see her coming along doing something else. So let's hope she will come back and give us another side of Audra McDonald.
We're now going to talk about Windows at the Finborough Theatre. This is a 1922 play by John Galsworthy. John Galsworthy, of course, best known for the Foresight Saga, his sequence of books, and also winning the Nobel Prize for Literature. He also wrote several interesting plays. His play The Skin Game was filmed by Alfred Hitchcock in 1931 and also was revived by The Orange Tree in 2007. His plays tend to be pretty well made, and there's an air about this one I think is a little bit George Bernard Shaw about it. His plays were often very campaigning. One of his famous plays, Silver Box, is about the theft of a silver box, where there's a difference between whether it was an unemployed person who took it or sort of a rich son who took it. You know, it looks at how justice would affect them. And that's kind of what he's doing in this play. He's looking at the differences in class and the differences of expectation, especially when you've recently come out of prison, and how you might get treated by, you know, the criminal justice system, and also how you might get treated by other people. It is directed here by the actor Jeffrey Beavers and designed by Alex Marker, and the cast includes Janet Amsden, Caroline Backhouse, Charlotte Brimble, Vincent Brimble, Jacob Coleman, Duncan Moore, David Shelley, Eleanor Sutton, and Christopher White. Paul, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Well, thanks, Tim. Actually, I think John Galsworthy rather describes it as a comedy for idealists and others. And actually, I think what it is quite fascinating in this tradition now that the Finborough has in sort of resurrecting plays that haven't had a production in years. And just having recently done Just to Get Married, which hadn't been performed in over 100 years, I believe. This one is the first professional UK production in 85 years. And it's really about a writer and his family, and Geoffrey March, who's this moderately successful writer, and they're living in this very civilized house in Hampstead. And he suggests to his family that they employ a young woman with a questionable past as their new maid, because they're having such difficulty getting help. And what they then suddenly find is, well, maybe because her questionable past is a bit too questionable, and, you know, what's going to happen there, particularly when his son begins to fall in love with her. And suddenly all this wonderful idealism, you know, the idea of rehabilitation and all these liberal-minded values are put to the test. And it's quite funny, actually, because some of this, even though it was set in a period just after the First World War, you know, a lot of these issues we're still grappling with today. And I think this is what's fascinating about resurrecting these pieces, because it allows you to actually look at them through a different lens, but actually still explore the same issues that, you know, they were dealing with in its day. I think it's a fantastic production, and what really sets it apart is actually the idea of treating this very serious subject about a woman who actually killed her baby because she didn't want it to be taken away because it was an illegitimate child. And, you know, how people reacted to it in its day. The program notes also talk about the history and the context of this. So it was quite a topical story in its day as well. And because there was a lot of campaigning that women shouldn't go to prison for this sort of thing, which is what they had been doing. And it's interesting that they chose this, and I suspect it was probably a lot more shocking in its day than it is watching that now. But having said that, what you experience is the sort of the family tension, the family relationship. This is a family that's slightly troubled because his son is, you know, then starts falling in love with this lady, and then what happens from that? I think the cast assembled are terrific for that. You've got David Shelley as Geoffrey March, who's this very well-thought idealist. And he ends up having these great philosophical debates with his window cleaner, which is, you know, where part of a lot of the comedy comes from, the window cleaner played by Vincent Brimble. And then his daughter, the window cleaner's daughter, Faith, played by Charlotte Brimble, is just a delight as this fairly determined woman who actually knows what she wants in life and, you know, rationally talks about the infanticide was an act of love because she didn't want to bring a child in this world to then have it taken away from her. So it's quite a fascinating piece that how the, sort of the clash of these two groups of people in this very pleasant dining room set in Hampstead takes place. And all throughout there's sort of subtle digs about the ideals of modern Britain. There's a lot of comments about the poor quality of politicians, which I think both people in the 1920s but also in the present day could identify with. And there's a lot of philosophical debate about primal urges giving way to, you know, morality and things like that. And, you know, while there's no surprises perhaps in this piece, there's quite a few laughs along the way, and it's quite fascinating what it says overall. I also loved how this production once again transforms the space of Finborough into something else. So that's by Alex Marco, sort of, and you do feel like you're in a Highgate dining room in the 1920s. And the way the audience sits in the theatre, it's like you're just part of this dinner party, just watching all the action unfold right in front of you. And I think there's this wonderful line too that Mr. Bly's character, the window cleaner, comes in. He says, "Hardly worth the while to clean them. After all, like life, they just get dirty again." And you think, the more things change, the more things, some things stay the same. And I think the pacing is quite good in this piece. I think, all told, it's yet another excellent and enjoyable production worth catching at the Finborough. Do you agree, Tim?
Yeah, I thought it was very good fun. I mean, I was reminded, I did a little bit of Pygmalion, George Bernard Shaw's play. I mean, he is a big friend of George Bernard Shaw, I believe. And the idea of Alfred Doolittle, the philosopher dustman, which George Bernard Shaw has in it, and of course he has the daughter Eliza, who comes into the house of these rather hidebound people, or rather strange people in the case of Henry Higgins, and changes and messes up their life, and that's something that kind of happens here, but much lighter and much more fun. I mean, I'm not sure that it's a really great play, but it's certainly a very good play, and well made and well put together, and very interesting to see it on. I should also mention another play of John Galsworthy's that was on more recently. The Chichester Festival Theatre did a production of Strife, which is much more about a strike in a mine, I think, in Wales. That was on last year and starred Bertie Carvel and William Gaunt, amongst other people. But this play, on the windows, I mean, there's something very odd about it, as a pick, because it's kind of play, it feels like the sort of thing that you put on, rather like you'd put on a TV series these days. Because nowadays, when you put on a play, you're trying to say something very particular and make it very theatrical. This feels sort of as if, I'm going to do this one and I'm going to write another play and then another play and another play. And it's just being able to exercise these ideas without necessarily wanting to have a great hit. That isn't to say that this isn't good play, but it did feel that kind of insubstantial, almost as if it's the next play you write rather than a particular masterpiece. It's not, something that's really great in that sense. So I did wonder, I thought that, I don't think it is to denigrate it, because it's very well worth seeing and it is very well done by the cast, but I did find the whole window cleaner setup, I just thought, do they really need their windows cleaned that often? He's always there. He's there every day.
They do for the plot development.
Yes. And why is he cleaning them inside, not outside?
I think that's the limitations of the film.
Yeah, yes. I mean, there's certain limitations of the set. I mean, you can understand it because, London was very polluted in the early 20th century. So you can quite understand you wouldn't put out white clothes on a washing line in London because they would come back grey or even black. You probably did need a friendly neighbourhood window cleaner to come round a few times a week.
Come round and wipe the soot off.
Yes.
But interestingly, you say about Pygmalion, because actually it is a bit, the story is a bit Pygmalion-like, but actually at least the family don't want to change her. They have a different view. It's a little bit more subtler, I felt, that they just want to give her a leg up on her way. And actually I think that was how then she reacts to that is actually quite fascinating as towards the end of the piece, because actually it's more like they're well-intentioned and then she goes back. So it's almost like, they offered Eliza to, help her open a flower shop and she told them where they could stick the flowers. So actually in some ways, it is like Pygmalion because, the class differential and the stock characters. But actually, without giving too much away, although I think I probably have now, the reactions in the end of it, I felt, were a bit more subtle. And it's making me laugh anyway, thinking about it.
Yes. Like a proper mid-20th century English thriller, it does have a third act detective.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.